essential tension implicit in scientific research. But that rejection of science in favor of another occupation is, I think, the only sort of paradigm rejection to which counterinstances by themselves can lead. Once a first paradigm through which to view nature has been found, there is no such thing as research in the absence of any paradigm. To reject one paradigm without simultaneously substituting another is to reject science itself. That act reflects not on the paradigm, but on the man. Inevitably, he will be seen by his colleagues as the carpenter who blames his tools. The same point can be made, at least equally effectively, in reverse. There is no such thing as research without counterinstances. For what is it that differentiates normal science from science in a crisis state? Not surely that the former confronts no counterinstances. On the contrary, what we previously called the puzzles that constitute normal science exist only because no paradigm that provides a basis for scientific research ever completely resolves all its problems. The very few that have ever seemed to do so, e.g. geometric optics, have shortly ceased to yield research problems at all, and have instead become tools for engineering. Excepting those that are exclusively instrumental, every problem that normal science sees as a puzzle can be seen, from another viewpoint, as a counterinstance, and thus as a source of crisis. Copernicus saw as counterinstances what most of Ptolemy's other successors had seen as puzzles in the match between observation and theory. Lavoisier saw as a counterinstance what Priestley had seen as a successfully solved puzzle in the articulation of the phlogiston theory. And Einstein saw as counterinstances what Lorentz, Fitzgerald, and others had seen as puzzles in the articulation of Newton's and Maxwell's theories. Furthermore, even the existence of crisis does not, by itself, transform a puzzle into a counterinstance. There is no such sharp dividing line. Instead, by proliferating versions of the paradigm, crisis loosens the rules of normal puzzle solving in ways that ultimately permit a new paradigm to emerge. There are, I think, only two alternatives. Either no scientific theory ever confronts a counterinstance, or all such theories confront counterinstances at all times. How can the situation have seemed otherwise? That question necessarily leads to the historical and critical elucidation of philosophy, and those topics are here barred. But we can at least note two reasons why science has seemed to provide so apt an illustration of the generalization that truth and falsity are uniquely and unequivocally determined by the confrontation of statement with fact. Normal science does, and must continually strive to, bring theory and fact into closer agreement. And that activity can easily be seen as testing, or as a search for confirmation or falsification. Instead, its object is to solve a puzzle, for whose very existence the validity of the paradigm must be assumed. Failure to achieve a solution discredits only the scientist, and not the theory. Here, even more than above, the proverb applies. It is a poor carpenter who blames his tools. In addition, the manner in which science pedagogy entangles discussion of a theory with remarks on its exemplary applications has helped to reinforce a confirmation theory drawn predominantly from other sources. Given the slightest reason for doing so, the man who reads a science text can easily take the applications to be the evidence for the theory, the reasons why it ought to be believed. But science students accept theories on the authority of teacher and text, not because of evidence. What alternatives have they, or what competence? The applications given in texts are not there as evidence, but because learning them is part of learning the paradigm at the base of current practice. If applications were set forth as evidence, then the very failure of texts to suggest alternative interpretations, or to discuss problems for which scientists have failed to produce paradigm solutions, would convict their authors of extreme bias. There is not the slightest reason for such an indictment. How then, to return to the initial question, do scientists respond to the awareness of an anomaly in the fit between theory and nature? What has just been said indicates that even a discrepancy, unaccountably larger than that experienced in other applications of the theory, need not draw any very profound response. There are always some discrepancies. Even the most stubborn ones usually respond at last to normal practice. Very often, scientists are willing to wait, particularly if there are many problems available in other parts of the field. We have already noted, for example, that during the 60 years after Newton's original computation, the predicted motion of the moon's perigee remained only half of that observed. As Europe's best mathematical physicists continued to wrestle unsuccessfully with the well-known discrepancy, there were occasional proposals for a modification of Newton's inverse square law. But no one took these proposals very seriously, and in practice, this patience with a major anomaly proved justified. Clairaut, in 1750, was able to show that only the mathematics of the application had been wrong, and that Newtonian theory could stand as before. Even in cases where no mere mistake seems quite possible, perhaps because the mathematics involved is simpler or of a familiar and elsewhere successful sort, persistent and recognized anomaly does not always induce crisis. No one seriously questioned Newtonian theory because of the long-recognized discrepancies between predictions from that theory and both the speed of sound and the motion of Mercury. The first discrepancy was ultimately, and quite unexpectedly, resolved by experiments on heat, undertaken for a very different purpose. The second vanished with the general theory of relativity, after a crisis that it had had no role in creating. Apparently neither had seemed sufficiently fundamental to evoke the malaise that goes with crisis. They could be recognized as counter-instances and still be set aside for later work. It follows that if an anomaly is to evoke crisis, it must usually be more than just an anomaly. There are always difficulties somewhere in the paradigm-nature fit. Most of them are set right sooner or later, often by processes that could not have been foreseen. The scientist who pauses to examine every anomaly he notes will seldom get significant work done. We therefore have to ask what it is that makes an anomaly seem worth concerted scrutiny, and to that question, there is probably no fully general answer. The cases we have already examined are characteristic, but scarcely prescriptive. Sometimes an anomaly will clearly call into question explicit and fundamental generalizations of the paradigm, as the problem of ether drag did for those who accepted Maxwell's theory. Or, as in the Copernican Revolution, an anomaly without apparent fundamental import may evoke crisis if the applications that it inhibits have a particular practical importance, in this case, for calendar design and astrology. Or, as in 18th century chemistry, the development of normal science may transform an anomaly that had previously been only a vexation into a source of crisis. The problem of weight relations had a very different status after the evolution of pneumatic chemical techniques. Presumably, there are still other circumstances that can make an anomaly particularly pressing, and ordinarily several of these will combine. We have already noted, for example, that one source of the crisis that confronted Copernicus was the mere length of time during which astronomers had wrestled, unsuccessfully, with the reduction of the residual discrepancies in Ptolemy's system. When, for these reasons or others like them, an anomaly comes to seem more than just another puzzle of normal science, the transition to crisis and to extraordinary science has begun. The anomaly itself now comes to be more generally recognized as such by the profession. More and more attention is devoted to it by more and more of the field's most eminent men. If it still continues to resist, as it usually does not, many of them may come to view its resolution as the subject matter of their discipline. For them, the field will no longer look quite the same as it had earlier. Part of its different appearance results simply from the new fixation point of scientific scrutiny. An even more important source of change is the divergent nature of the numerous partial solutions that concerted attention to the problem has made available. The early attacks upon the resistant problem will have followed the paradigm rules quite closely. But, with continuing resistance, more and more of the attacks upon it will have involved some minor, or not so minor, articulation of the paradigm. No two of them quite alike. Each partially successful, but none sufficiently so to be accepted as paradigm by the group. Through this proliferation of divergent articulations, more and more frequently they will come to be described as ad hoc adjustments, the rules of normal science become increasingly blurred. Though there still is a paradigm, few practitioners prove to be entirely agreed about what it is. Even formerly standard solutions of solved problems are called in question. When acute, this situation is sometimes recognized by the scientists involved. Copernicus complained that in his day astronomers were so inconsistent in these astronomical investigations that they cannot even explain or observe the constant length of the seasonal year. With them, he continued, it is as though an artist were to gather the hands, feet, head, and other members for his images from diverse models, each part excellently drawn, but not related to a single body. And since they in no way match each other, the result would be monster rather than man. Einstein, restricted by current usage to less florid language, wrote only, "It was as if the ground had been pulled out from under one, with no firm foundation to be seen anywhere, upon which one could have built." And Wolfgang Pauli, in the months before Heisenberg's paper on matrix mechanics pointed the way to a new quantum theory, wrote to a friend, "At the moment, physics is again terribly confused. In any case, it is too difficult for me, and I wish I had been a movie comedian or something of the sort, and had never heard of physics." That testimony is particularly impressive if contrasted with Pauli's words less than 5 months later. "Heisenberg's type of mechanics has again given me hope and joy in life. To be sure, it does not supply the solution to the riddle, but I believe it is again possible to march forward." Such explicit recognitions of breakdown are extremely rare. But the effects of crisis do not entirely depend upon its conscious recognition. What can we say these effects are? Only two of them seem to be universal. All crises begin with the blurring of a paradigm and the consequent loosening of the rules for normal research. In this respect, research during crisis very much resembles research during the pre-paradigm period, except that in the former, the locus of difference is both smaller and more clearly defined. And all crises close in one of three ways. Sometimes normal science ultimately proves able to handle the crisis-provoking problem, despite the despair of those who have seen it as the end of an existing paradigm. On other occasions, the problem resists even apparently radical new approaches. Then scientists may conclude that no solution will be forthcoming in the present state of their field. The problem is labeled and set aside for a future generation with more developed tools. Or finally, the case that will most concern us here, a crisis may end with the emergence of a new candidate for paradigm, and with the ensuing battle over its acceptance. This last mode of closure will be considered at length in later sections, but we must anticipate a bit of what will be said there in order to complete these remarks about the evolution and anatomy of the crisis state. The transition from a paradigm in crisis to a new one from which a new tradition of normal science can emerge is far from a cumulative process, one achieved by an articulation or extension of the old paradigm. Rather, it is a reconstruction of the field from new fundamentals, a reconstruction that changes some of the field's most elementary theoretical generalizations, as well as many of its paradigm methods and applications. During the transition period, there will be a large but never complete overlap between the problems that can be solved by the old and by the new paradigm. But there will also be a decisive difference in the modes of solution. When the transition is complete, the profession will have changed its view of the field, its methods, and its goals. One perceptive historian, viewing a classic case of a science's reorientation by paradigm change, recently described it as picking up the other end of the stick, a process that involves handling the same bundle of data as before, but placing them in a new system of relations with one another by giving them a different framework. Others, who have noted this aspect of scientific advance, have emphasized its similarity to a change in visual gestalt. The marks on paper that were first seen as a bird are now seen as an antelope, or vice versa. That parallel can be misleading. Scientists do not see something as something else. Instead, they simply see it. We have already examined some of the problems created by saying that Priestley saw oxygen as dephlogisticated air. In addition, the scientist does not preserve the gestalt subject's freedom to switch back and forth between ways of seeing. Nevertheless, the switch of gestalt, particularly because it is today so familiar, is a useful elementary prototype for what occurs in full-scale paradigm shift. The preceding anticipation may help us recognize crisis as an appropriate prelude to the emergence of new theories, particularly since we have already examined a small-scale version of the same process in discussing the emergence of discoveries. Just because the emergence of a new theory breaks with one tradition of scientific practice and introduces a new one conducted under different rules and within a different universe of discourse, it is likely to occur only when the first tradition is felt to have gone badly astray. That remark is, however, no more than a prelude to the investigation of the crisis state, and unfortunately, the questions to which it leads demand the competence of the psychologist, even more than that of the historian. What is extraordinary research like? How is anomaly made law-like? How do scientists proceed when aware only that something has gone fundamentally wrong, at a level with which their training has not equipped them to deal? Those questions need far more investigation, and it ought not all be historical. What follows will necessarily be more tentative and less complete than what has gone before. Often a new paradigm emerges, at least in embryo, before a crisis has developed far or been explicitly recognized. Lavoisier's work provides a case in point. His sealed note was deposited with the French Academy less than a year after the first thorough study of weight relations in the phlogiston theory, and before Priestley's publications had revealed the full extent of the crisis in pneumatic chemistry. Or again, Thomas Young's first accounts of the wave theory of light appeared at a very early stage of a developing crisis in optics, one that would be almost unnoticeable except that, with no assistance from Young, it had grown to an international scientific scandal within a decade of the time he first wrote. In cases like these, one can say only that a minor breakdown of the paradigm, and the very first blurring of its rules for normal science, were sufficient to induce in someone a new way of looking at the field. What intervened between the first sign of trouble and the recognition of an available alternate must have been largely unconscious. In other cases, however, those of Copernicus, Einstein, and contemporary nuclear theory, for example, considerable time elapses between the first consciousness of breakdown and the emergence of a new paradigm. When that occurs, the historian may capture at least a few hints of what extraordinary science is like. Faced with an admittedly fundamental anomaly in theory, the scientist's first effort will often be to isolate it more precisely and to give it structure. Though now aware that they cannot be quite right, he will push the rules of normal science harder than ever to see, in the area of difficulty, just where and how far they can be made to work. Simultaneously, he will seek for ways of magnifying the breakdown, of making it more striking, and perhaps also more suggestive than it had been when displayed in experiments, the outcome of which was thought to be known in advance. And in the latter effort, more than in any other part of the post-paradigm development of science, he will look almost like our most prevalent image of the scientist. He will, in the first place, often seem a man searching at random, trying experiments just to see what will happen, looking for an effect whose nature he cannot quite guess. Simultaneously, since no experiment can be conceived without some sort of theory, the scientist in crisis will constantly try to generate speculative theories that, if successful, may disclose the road to a new paradigm, and, if unsuccessful, can be surrendered with relative ease. Kepler's account of his prolonged struggle with the motion of Mars, and Priestley's description of his response to the proliferation of new gases, provide classic examples of the more random sort of research produced by the awareness of anomaly. But probably the best illustrations of all come from contemporary research in field theory and on fundamental particles. In the absence of a crisis that made it necessary to see just how far the rules of normal science could stretch, would the immense effort required to detect the neutrino have seemed justified? Or, if the rules had not obviously broken down at some undisclosed point, would the radical hypothesis of parity non-conservation have been either suggested or tested? Like much other research in physics during the past decade, these experiments were in part attempts to localize and define the source of a still diffuse set of anomalies. This sort of extraordinary research is often, though by no means generally, accompanied by another. It is, I think, particularly in periods of acknowledged crisis, that scientists have turned to philosophical analysis as a device for unlocking the riddles of their field. Scientists have not generally needed or wanted to be philosophers. Indeed, normal science usually holds creative philosophy at arm's length, and probably for good reasons. To the extent that normal research work can be conducted by using the paradigm as a model, rules and assumptions need not be made explicit. In Section 5, we noted that the full set of rules sought by philosophical analysis need not even exist. But that is not to say that the search for assumptions, even for non-existent ones, cannot be an effective way to weaken the grip of a tradition upon the mind, and to suggest the basis for a new one. It is no accident that the emergence of Newtonian physics in the 17th century, and of relativity and quantum mechanics in the 20th, should have been both preceded and accompanied by fundamental philosophical analyses of the contemporary research tradition. Nor is it an accident that in both these periods, the so-called thought experiment should have played so critical a role in the progress of research. As I have shown elsewhere, the analytical thought experimentation that bulks so large in the writings of Galileo, Einstein, Bohr, and others is perfectly calculated to expose the old paradigm to existing knowledge, in ways that isolate the root of crisis with a clarity unattainable in the laboratory. With the deployment, singly or together, of these extraordinary procedures, one other thing may occur. By concentrating scientific attention upon a narrow area of trouble, and by preparing the scientific mind to recognize experimental anomalies for what they are, crisis often proliferates new discoveries. We have already noted how the awareness of crisis distinguishes Lavoisier's work on oxygen from Priestley's. And oxygen was not the only new gas that the chemists aware of anomaly were able to discover in Priestley's work. Or again, new optical discoveries accumulated rapidly just before and during the emergence of the wave theory of light. Some, like polarization by reflection, were a result of the accidents that concentrated work in an area of trouble makes likely. Malus, who made the discovery, was just starting work for the Academy's prize essay on double refraction, a subject widely known to be in an unsatisfactory state. Others, like the light spot at the center of the shadow of a circular disk, were predictions from the new hypothesis, ones whose success helped to transform it to a paradigm for later work. And still others, like the colors of scratches and of thick plates, were effects that had often been seen and occasionally remarked before, but that, like Priestley's oxygen, had been assimilated to well-known effects in ways that prevented their being seen for what they were. A similar account could be given of the multiple discoveries that, from about 1895, were a constant concomitant of the emergence of quantum mechanics. Extraordinary research must have still other manifestations and effects, but in this area we have scarcely begun to discover the questions that need to be asked. Perhaps, however, no more are needed at this point. The preceding remarks should suffice to show how crisis simultaneously loosens the stereotypes and provides the incremental data necessary for a fundamental paradigm shift. Sometimes the shape of the new paradigm is foreshadowed in the structure that extraordinary research has given to the anomaly. Einstein wrote that before he had any substitute for classical mechanics, he could see the interrelation between the known anomalies of black body radiation, the photoelectric effect, and specific heats. More often, no such structure is consciously seen in advance. Instead, the new paradigm, or a sufficient hint to permit later articulation, emerges all at once, sometimes in the middle of the night, in the mind of a man deeply immersed in crisis. What the nature of that final stage is, how an individual invents, or finds he has invented, a new way of giving order to data now all assembled, must here remain inscrutable, and maybe permanently so. Let us here note only one thing about it. Almost always, the men who achieve these fundamental inventions of a new paradigm have been either very young or very new to the field whose paradigm they change. And perhaps that point need not have been made explicit, for obviously these are the men who, being little committed by prior practice to the traditional rules of normal science, are particularly likely to see that those rules no longer define a playable game, and to conceive another set that can replace them. The resulting transition to a new paradigm is scientific revolution, a subject that we are, at long last, prepared to approach directly. Note first, however, one last and apparently elusive respect in which the material of the last three sections has prepared the way. Until Section 6, where the concept of anomaly was first introduced, the terms revolution and extraordinary science may have seemed equivalent. More important, neither term may have seemed to mean more than non-normal science, a circularity that will have bothered at least a few listeners. In practice, it need not have done so. we are about to discover that a similar circularity is characteristic of scientific theories. Bothersome or not, however,